Ian Fraser is a prolific writer whose serious pieces are never without humor, while his humorous pieces are always thought-provoking. He's amused, informed, and enlightened us for over 40 years in various publications, including The New Yorker, Outside, The Atlantic Monthly, Mother Jones, and briefly, the girly magazine We. He published a collection of his writing under the title Hogs Wild in June, and that brought him back to our show to talk about it. We're rebroadcasting that conversation for you now. Some of the pieces in this book are humorous and intended just to entertain, but even the more serious ones are filled with funny asides and are told very much in your familiar voice. Is your writing process different when you're writing with the sole goal of being funny?
Yeah. I mean, when you're trying to write a funny piece, a day is a different kind of day, a day of work, because if you come up with one funny line, you've pretty much done your job for the day. I mean, at least you can be somewhat satisfied. But if you're writing a nonfiction piece, you've got to – there's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of explaining to do usually.
And then the humorous thing just occurs to you in the process?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes a fact will just be kind of a strange and funny fact. I mean, it's not even – exactly funny, but just something that really tickles you or piques you in the same way that a humor
the line. Incongruity of it.
Yeah, and the incongruity, the I guess irony for want of a better term.
Is one easier to do than the other?
Humor rather than reporting?
Or vice versa?
Each one makes me want to do the other. The strictures of the one make me want to do the other, because humor, you don't get the thrill of kind of just usually of just writing a whole bunch of stuff and having it all sort of look like it might work. And with nonfiction, the fact that you are constantly paying attention to something outside yourself, at least much of the time, it's like you're doing a sketch and you're trying to have it look like what you're drawing, you know, so that a lot of nonfiction is I think maybe more of a discipline. And humor is something that comes like the leaves to the trees.
Has your writing changed over time? Are the kinds of topics you're attracted to changed?
Yes. I feel much more like I have a more civic feeling now that I'm an older person. I have children and I see young people, and I just feel like, you know, I'm not as interested in just getting off a good, funny thing, you know, like, I mean, it's almost like, this will seem a weird analogy, but if you think of the movie Animal House, right, and you think of all that, there are all these funny moments in it, and at the end, the John Belushi character, you see what happened to him later, and he becomes a senator, right, mm-hmm. at the end. And now I'm afraid, you know, that's how you basically go. You go from humor to something that is big. I mean, look at Al Franken. He's taken a civic, you know, path later in his life, and I admire it.
Unfortunately for John Belushi, the end was quite different.
Right, and a long time ago.
Now, you do a lot of research, and I've talked to people who do that. They always talk about avoiding the pitfalls. You just want to include everything have discovered.
Yeah. I once did I wrote a book about the Great Plains, and I was following this guy who did wonderful on-site research with Sioux Indians who had been at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and he would just interview them, but he never published anything. And this guy's name was Ricker, and Nebraska Historical Society, it said, unfortunately, Dr. Ricker became lost in his research. And it's very beneficial to people later who use this research, but he never wrote anything. And sometimes the research can just be so unbelievably interesting.
How did you deal with your last book, Travels in Siberia? Just pretty much write about what you saw without.
Well, it was travel is helpful in that it gives you a plot. You're from going from A to B, and that's always a structure, and that's useful to you. So you can leave in and leave out in terms of what is along the route, you know. And I took a number of trips, but the route was whatever route I was on was sort of the controlling thing.
In describing airports, you said Russian versus American. The Russians smelled like diesel, and the Americans smelled like Cinnabon.
Right, yeah. Well, if you come to Alaska, if you fly in from Russia to Alaska, when you leave Russia, you get this smell of just strong diesel fuel. And when you land at Anchorage Airport and you get out of the plane, you get a strong smell of Cinnabon. And that's really like the two countries.
I've read that when your father was interviewing at Standard Oil, he was asked the question, what's the ultimate ambition in life? And he gave an answer that got him the job, but probably wouldn't today.
He said his ambition was to drink up all the beer in the world. Somebody here did good research to notice that, yes. And he got the job at Standard Oil. Well,
but it sounds to me like you also got the sense of humor from him.
Well, he was a contrarian type of person, and he shocked people all the time. His boss, the guy who hired him, was the head of research there. And he said, well, anybody that would say that, I thought, we'll probably get something pretty unusual from him. And they did invent several major earth-shaking things in Standard Oil research, so they were right to hire him.
Is being a writer something like being an inventor, although in your case you even have a patent for a real invention?
Right. My father had about 16 patents, and I have one.
Which we've talked about in the past.
Which we just talked about the last time I was here, I think.
Yeah.
It's the same thing as like discovering a butterfly and getting it named after you, you know? It's a kind of little bit of immortality.
How did you come to work at We, which was one of those Playboy knockoffs?
This always comes up.
You have to start somewhere?
Well, I was on the Harvard Lampoon, and they were starting We in Chicago. That is, Playboy already existed, and they were starting this magazine for younger people. So they basically said, anybody there at the Lampoon that wants a job, come on out to Chicago. And I wanted to go out to Chicago. I had friends out there, and I sort of thought it might be a way to write something funny. It was not the right job for me, or probably for anybody, but I only was there a very brief time before this kind of was born home to me, but I did do it for, I don't know, 6 weeks or something.
When you interviewed at the New Yorker, how did William Shawn react to that line on your resume?
Well, he asked me what I was writing at We, and I said, well, I was doing a lot of bondage and discipline stuff. And Sean was a very proper man. And he was just appalled, really. It's just face fell. And he changed the subject immediately. And I felt that I still feel horrible that I said that. It's just like, how did I say such an idiotic thing?
Well, you didn't say one to drink a bowl of beer.
No, but yeah, it's similar. Right. That's what my dad said, the beer, and I said the B&D. So.
I'm speaking with Ian Fraser, whose latest book is a collection of essays. It's called Selected Reporting Pieces. Under the title Hogs Wild. One particularly sweet piece in this collection is a kind of a tribute to phone booths. How did a phone booth prove critical to your life?
Well, I just always had this affection for phone booths, and I'm not really sure why. But the story that I tell in the piece is that at one point in my life, I moved to Northwest Montana. I was living by myself. I had split up with my girlfriend, and she had moved to Sarasota, Florida. And she then called me, and we were on our way to getting back together, and we've been married for 33 years. But the phone, she called me, and we talked. She was on a payphone, and I wrote the number down on the wall of my house in Montana. And then the next day, I said, oh, I want to talk to her again. Mm-hmm. And I just called that number, which is a payphone. She happened to be walking by on the street of Sarasota.
It could have been Clark Kent.
It could have been. Well, in a way, I like to think it was.
So she just said, that's a great coincidence.
Yeah,
what
but it was
happened
amazing
if she wasn't thing. Walking by?
I don't know, but she was walking by. And she heard the phone ring, and she thought, why would that phone be for me? But then she thought, well, what would it hurt to answer it? And it was incredible. And when she picked up, I wasn't all that surprised either.
Something very different would have happened if it was in the age of cell phones.
I have no idea what that would have been like. I mean, a lot of the point of that piece is to talk about how a payphone is a place and a cell phone is adrift. It's nowhere, you know? And all of those payphone places are now, or many, many, many of them are gone. And so you kind of lose. I have a very deep affinity with place. I don't know why. Everything I write about seems to be about place.
And if you were traveling in a certain part of New York City, you wanted to know where the cell phones, not the cell phones, the payphone booths were located, because sometimes you just needed to make that call.
Right, and you would end up having favorite payphones sometimes. There were payphones that you knew it was a pretty dependable payphone. It was always there, and you'd often get to it and not find anybody else there,
The title piece is Hogs Wild, something that you wrote about feral hogs. What got you interested in that subject?
Well, that was actually an assignment by The New Yorker. My editor, Susan Morrison, had that idea.
She said, go out and write about
feral
hogs? Yeah,
she said, this might interest you. And there was a guy, I think he still works at The New Yorker possibly, who was a big hunter, and he would often go hunting for feral hogs. And so he gave me some info about it, and I started looking into it. And it is an incredible subject. I do think feral hogs will one day take over the planet.
Early on in the description of the history of feral hogs, you say that in frontier times, farmers let their hogs run loose and then collected them on butchering day, but that many hogs chose to skip this event naturally.
Right. Yeah.
Are they the ones who became feral hogs?
They're the ancestors of feral hogs, but hogs kept escaping throughout frontier times.
So is this just a matter of survival of the fittest in a way?
Well, hogs
are smarter?
Yeah, they're incredibly smart. I mean, hogs are as smart as dogs or smarter than dogs. They're omnivorous. They're incredibly adaptive. They live in places that are tough for us to develop, no matter how much we want to develop every square foot of land. We can't develop swamps, and they are perfectly happy in swamps. They don't have sweat glands. They like to hang out in swamps and be nice and soggy all the time.
Although people do hunt them.
Oh, everybody hunts them. I mean, that is to say, there are no closed seasons on hogs. There's no bag limit. Hogs are, every man's hand is against the hog.
I know you're a fisherman. Are you also a hunter?
No. I haven't been. I have in the past, but I haven't hunted in a long time.
Is hunting what made them become an invasive species in many states?
Well, there are guys who want to hunt them and who will trap them down south and then bring them up and release them, all of which is illegal. I mean, I guess the trapping isn't illegal, but the transporting and releasing probably is. Certainly, releasing an invasive animal like that is not very, it's a mischievous act, but that is thought to be the way that hogs have gotten to places in the north like Indiana and Illinois.
You saw a correlation between feral hogs and the election of Bush over Kerry.
Yeah, in 2004. All of the counties, so many counties that have feral hogs voted for Bush. And it's a very bizarre and striking correspondence between those two things.
None of those pollsters have noticed that.
Just check out the feral hogs. I mean, if you find that a state has become overrun with feral hogs in the last 4 years, it's very likely to vote differently than it did 4 years ago. So,
a piece I vividly remembered reading before because the images in it are so horrifying and so funny is about the invasive flying fish. Do you have an affinity for invasive feral creatures?
Well, invasive animals, a lot of what the book is about is how life goes on living. And I find it fascinating the way living things adapt and work their way into all different kinds of situations, and particularly ones that are created by human beings. And the Asian carp in the Mississippi watershed system, but dramatically in the Illinois River in Illinois, are just a phenomenon like you can't believe. There's so many of these fish, and they jump out of the water when they are alarmed by a motorboat engine. And they will smack into you as you're speeding down. I mean, I suppose a lot of people have seen those videos.
And because they do not naturally from these areas, they don't have natural predators?
Well, they do have natural predators when they're little. You know, the fry, I think, are eaten by other fish. But they just happen. The Illinois River is one of the richest environmental systems in the world. And it used to be a place where commercial fishermen fished. Today, commercial fishermen fish there and catch catch Asian carp to sell. But it's just...
They taste good?
I did not taste an Asian. I didn't taste... And I didn't have any feral
Chicago
hog either.
Chicago is famous for its restaurants.
They do serve it somewhere in Chicago, I'm told.
Now, you have two essays that are about homelessness in New York City. The first one appears in the book is about a soup kitchen and a writing workshop that you started there. How did you discover the Church of the Holy Apostles?
I actually discovered it many years ago because Garrison Keillor did a benefit for it. And I thought, wow, what a cool thing to do. And so I started going over there. It's a wonderful place.
One of the funniest encounters you tell about is the guy who told you that he wasn't going to join because he had already done it.
Yeah.
And he had been ripped off by John Cheever.
Well, he said, I did this before, and when I was at Attica Prison, and he said, or no, at Ossining, and he said, and I did this before, and with a better writer than you. And I said, oh, who was that? And he said, John Cheever. And then he said, and John Cheever wrote Falconer, and he had a bestseller, and I didn't get anything out of it, so I'm not doing any more writer's workshops. And I thought that was kind of wild.
Now, what about homelessness today? A lot has been blamed on the de Blasio administration, but didn't homelessness kind of explode during the Bloomberg years, but was more hit?
Was more
hidden? I mean, it was less.
Oh, yeah. People didn't know that it was such a thing for a long time. People would say, oh, I think there are fewer homeless people. That was when I was mm-hmm. doing the reporting for the story. But in fact, the numbers just grew and grew, and they're continuing to grow. I mean, New York City, in terms of real estate, is brutal on ordinary people, I'm afraid
to
say.
Well, aren't there places for the homeless to go?
There are, but there are more homeless people than there are places to put them at the moment.
And one point you make is the astronomical cost of putting someone up in temporary substandard housing is compared to the rent subsidy that they might need. So why aren't we just doing rent subsidies the way we did in the past?
Well, rent subsidies have had a very complicated history, and I'm really not well informed enough now to go into what the situation is with it at the moment.
But has Albany cut back on funding?
There were several times when Albany cut back and the federal government cut back, and it became harder and harder and harder to get Section 8, which is basically subsidized housing. And people treasure, like, getting Section 8 is a great thing, you know, if you have difficulty making ends meet. But I mean, the situation just in paying a normal rent, that there's almost no place that you can get in the city where if you even got minimum wage, $15 an hour, you would have enough money for that to pay your rent. So it's a tough situation.
And gentrification has changed even the neighborhoods that people could have gone to in the past.
Right. And gentrification is not leaving behind apartments that can be occupied by people of a lower economic level. So It's just gotten tougher and tougher to find a place to live, as anybody who's tried in New York knows.
Is it true you were offered a job at Saturday Night Live?
A long, long time ago, I was, yes.
By
Lorne Michaels.
It?
I didn't take it back then because Mr. Sean was kind of a purist, and I went to talk to him, and he said, I was offered this job, and he said, well, many good writers have been lost to television. And I thought, oh, I don't want to be lost to television. I'd rather work at The New Yorker.
And you've remained at The New Yorker despite a number of changes in editors since.
Well,
Sean
I was
died.
Gone for 6 years. I left when Tina Brown was there. I didn't write for The New Yorker. But after David Remnick came, I was happy to go back.
Ian, as always, it's been a lot of pleasure talking with you.
It's fun to talk to you.